Okay, Representative Haas then would move approval of the minutes from the third meeting.
Pretty excited about it, I will do so.
That's right, and he's noticed that there were, everything was correct.
Yes, it is.
All right, thank you, Representative Haas. Is there any other additions or corrections to the minutes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, members. And we will get right into our student presentations then from the university students. Darlene, is it, from the Crookston campus? Welcome to the committee and the legislature. And why don't you just come down and introduce yourself for the tape and get right into your testimony. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Dolly Menzies, and I'm the representative for University of Minnesota Crookston. I'm a junior there, and I am majoring in communications with an emphasis in agriculture. I'm the third child of five from a single-parent household attending a college. I came to UMC because I was interested in the agriculture education program. UMC is sort of unique because it is the only college in Minnesota to have a collegiate FFA program. This was a deciding factor for me as I was very involved in FFA throughout high school. I was also very involved in community service and those sorts of programs when I was in high school as well. So that was an important attribute that I was looking for in the college as well. UMC has an outstanding reputation for service learning as well as community service involvement, and that enticed me to look further into the campus. I love the small feeling and the fact that I could be involved with numerous aspects of the college and accomplish a lot without overextending myself. I knew that my voice would be heard at UMC. Right now, I'm the manager of our information desk, a member of our executive board for our student programming, a member of a couple of other clubs like the Communication Club and CFFA. I've also had the opportunity to study abroad twice, once in Holland in Germany and this last summer in Angers, France. I personally found these experiences to be very rewarding, and I thank the university for their emphasis on global perspectives. When I was looking for a college campus, I was aware of UMC only through the FFA program, and had it not been for that, I wouldn't have known about it at all. Many of my classmates have never heard of UMC, but through my positive experiences, have become aware of the advantages that UMC has to offer, such as hands-on learning, small class sizes, and advanced technology. I have noticed through various involvements at UMC that we struggle within our budgetary constraints. Granted that we are the smallest campus of the U of M system, our staffing is significantly lower than those of our counterparts. For example, our admission consists of only four staff members, whereas Morris, who has 300 more students than UMC, has about double that staff. Due to this constant level of being understaffed, our faculty and staff are forced to split their time between multiple roles. While staffing levels may not seem to impact students on a daily basis, we do notice that they are pulled in multiple directions and are sometimes reluctant to ask questions or bring up issues knowing that they already have a full plate. Thankfully, this was not the case when I did have one bad experience with my financial aid packet in the fall of 2005. Because of a transition in the office and a miscommunication, my financial aid packet was put on hold, thereby resulting in the loss of my work study and all of my grants. This put me in a position where I wanted to further my education, but had no means of doing so. I found a non-work study job, which offset some of my living expenses, but not my tuition costs. I was then in a position to not be able to register for the classes in the next semester and would have had to withdraw from college. But without the last-minute grant that was offered by my financial aid director to cover the tuition costs from that semester and enabled me to register for classes. That experience showed me how valuable state and federal programs are to many students getting an education, as I would not be here today without them. I was also fortunate to offset my college expenses through grants, work state position, and serving as a resident advisor on my campus. I know that the Minnesota House has proposed a bill that would freeze the tuition for Minnesota residents, and it guarantees a stable tuition for 4 years. I think that this program would benefit many Minnesota residents and would also serve as an incentive to finish a degree in 4 years. I guess I just briefly stated my views on UMC, and thank you for this opportunity. Let's open up for any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Tony, for coming. Are there any questions, Representative Norris?
Mr. Chair, just one question. Do you have a professor by the name of Thompson that you've ever encountered?
Yes, I do. Kevin Thompson?
Yes.
Yes.
Just say hello.
Okay.
His mother's my cousin.
He's one of my favorites.
Thank you. It was just personal, but I appreciate the time.
Well, that's okay. If it's good constituent coverage for you, we're proud to help you out here. Dolly, can you explain again the mix-up on the financial package?
I'm not really sure. It was Kristen that year was going through a transition from directors and staffing. Our chancellor decided to redo our areas, and so for some reason there was a miscommunication in there, and for some reason it was put on hold since June. And I had worked through the summer at the college, and so I'm not sure why that happened, but it was put on hold. And then when they finally did write me an email, they just said, you don't have work study and you owe this much. So I'm not really sure why that happened. But.
And then you had a... that was able to guide you through it and fix the problem?
I tried to work through it to see if I could make the money, to make up the money that was sitting there, but there was no way I could. And so towards the end of the semester, I just went in and explained that to them, and she did some figuring, and somehow I found that grant to cover my expenses. But without that, I would have had to withdraw from college.
And if you don't mind me asking, how are you doing financially? Do you... what's your guess as far as what your debt might be, or are you doing?
I think I have around $8,000 in debt right now.
Well, any other questions? What's the problem?
Mr. Chair, could you just talk about your textbook experience? Do you have how that's working for you, and what the cost might be of that as well?
For textbooks?
Mm-hmm.
I think that I spend around $400 or $500 on textbooks every semester, being as most of my classes are, I need the textbook. It's not something that I can share, because I have a lot of computer classes and things like that, so you have to have your own. I guess that my experience hasn't been bad. I know that a lot of people complain on our campus that we don't get enough money for buybacks and those sorts of things, but I think that that's a complaint that most students have. So.
Mr. Chair, just another question. Because Crookston is well known for being the university that started with the laptop.
Yes.
What's your experience with that and the technology that you have that's associated with the laptops?
You know, I think that that's one of the greatest parts of Crookston is that we have the laptops and we are able to use them on a daily basis. The other thing is that our professors then use them. So a lot of our courses, they have a lot of the assignments or uploading of assignments onto the internet, a lot of PowerPoints and things of that nature are used in the classroom every single day. So we get that everyday kind of association with the computer.
Okay, and one final question that would tie the two together. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding textbooks and technology, have you ever heard the faculty talk about not having textbooks, and because you have that kind of access to technology and online learning kinds of opportunities?
You know, they try to incorporate both. So they kind of feel that it's still important to do the readings and do assignments out of the book, but they also try to use the technology side of it and make you go on the web and find certain things and find credible sources and those sorts of things. You get kind of both ends, but they feel that it's important on both ends, not to just have online things or just to have the textbook to kind of incorporate them together.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you very much for coming down, and appreciate your testimony. And I don't know if you gave us these gifts. Representative Atkins, is it legal for us to accept these pens? And
it is for the chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to have folks coming down in pairs, I think. Kristen Farmer and Cecilia Allen, did I murder that name?
Okay.
Welcome to the committee, ladies. Thank you for coming. Just identify yourselves, both of you and you.
Okay.
Begin your testimony.
My name is Kristen Farmer. I am currently a senior at the University of Minnesota Morris, and I am pursuing a degree in political science and economics.
My name is Cecilia Allen. I am a student at the University of Minnesota Morris. I'm a third year, and my majors are history and political science.
Awesome.
And I'll just shut up. Like I said before, my name is Kristen Farmer, and I am currently a senior at the University of Minnesota Morris. I've loved Morris. This is my fourth year, and it's been a great experience. It is, like it says, it's one of the top public liberal arts colleges in the United States, and it really stands true to that. I have learned so much, and I have gained so much from this university. I have been privileged to be involved in many different areas of the university when it comes to administration, when it comes to admissions, when it comes to residential life, and it has really taught me a lot. Unfortunately, I am a senior this year, and time has come, and it's ready for me to realize I have debt, and I need to be prepared and figure out how I'm supposed to pay for this. I will be honest with you. I have over half of the amount it costs me to go to this university. It's about $26,000 I owe. And to me, that's a little overwhelming, knowing that I've never been able to have a position that has even paid me $26,000 a year.
We haven't either, so...
Oh, really? Wow. Okay, we have something in common. this is good. So this is something that I'm realizing, knowing that I have to graduate, find a job, and pay other bills. Through my college experience, I've been able to find different areas to finance my college experience with working with residential life as an RA, and that has saved me quite a bit of money, but still, it's still been overwhelming. As coming from a family that makes well over $100,000 a year, I'll be frank with you, I am still unable to even pay the tuition costs at the University of Minnesota Morris. And the biggest thing is the financial aid burden. I feel as if coming from this family and working very hard that financial aid has not even been able to help me get through this personally. And that's one of the biggest concerns that many of my fellow peers have experienced. That's one concern I have. Another thing that has really surprised me through this year is the increase of tuition over the past 4 years that I've been here. Looking at the U of M website, I realized coming into the University of Minnesota Morris, I started to pay roughly about $13,000 a year with all the expenses, and now it's over almost $17,000 a year, which is a lot of money in my mind, and it's something that really keeps people from entering the university and has kept many of my fellow peers from continuing to pursue their degree, which I find is a very big concern. Personally, I feel as one of the representatives from Morris, our school is a great place to be, and I don't want students to be unable to attend this university because of the cost of tuition. And I'm asking you to hear my testimony and understand that this is very important to me and other peers at the University of Minnesota Morris. So thank you.
Thank you. Cecilia, why don't you just go into your testimony, and then if there's questions, we'll ask both of you at the same time.
Okay. I currently have roughly around $23,000 in debt. This is my third year. I have two left. Every semester it costs me around $300 for textbooks, so that's roughly $600 a year. And my majors happen to be one of the least expensive majors for textbooks. The total cost that it is to attend Morris per year is roughly $20,000 when you include tuition, on-campus housing, health insurance, things like that. The effects of the cost of tuition besides just my $23,000 in debt are that I will most likely have over $30,000 in debt when I graduate and will someday have to pay that off. When I first came to Morris, I'm a transfer student this year. Actually, I transferred from North Dakota, where school is far less expensive for me. So when I transferred to Morris, it was a bit of a shock, and I almost couldn't pay for school. Like, I was sitting in the financial aid office, And I started crying because I didn't know how I was going to be able to finance my education for this year, and it was a very frightening feeling. I ended up having to apply for extra loans and had to take out every possible loan I could to be able to afford school. I do have grants, however. I have federal grants. I'm not eligible for state grants because I'm not a resident. And those grants are extremely invaluable to me. If it wasn't for those, I wouldn't be able to pay for education. So there are probably students out there that wouldn't be able to afford their education if it wasn't for state grants also. My financial situation is that my father is disabled, and therefore his household is unable to contribute any income towards my education. So I basically have to just rely on myself and financial aid. I work about 60 hours a week during the summers to be able to support my living expenses during the school year. And even though it was a bit of a shock and it's going to increase my debt greatly, I feel like I made a very good decision when I chose to go to Morris. The school suits me very well, and I feel like I'm getting a very good education. And even though the tuition is fairly high, I think that it turned out okay in the end. But if the tuition like increases over 100% like it has lately, it wouldn't be worth it. The effects on the school that funding has caused has been that in recent years, Morris has exceeded its budget, and they've had to dip into their reserves. And so the new chancellor this year called for reviews of every division, and they're currently doing that now. And I serve as the student representative on the curriculum committee. And whenever proposals for new classes or new majors come up, the answer is always, we can't do that right now. We're under review. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't have the money to do that right now. We don't know what resources that's going to require, and the faculty are overstressed already, and they can't take that on. So that's kind of a shaky area right now for Morris. I know that my situation is not an extremely different one from a lot of other students. I know that a lot of other students' parents are unable to contribute to their education costs or unable to contribute enough money for their education costs. And so I think basically I'm a typical student with a lot of debt. That's it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you both very much for your testimony. Are there any questions of the witnesses at all? I guess I have one for Acilia. You said you were in your third year. You transferred. Is that why you have 2 years, 5 years, or was it difficult to get classes? And
No, it hasn't been difficult to get classes. I started out as a biology major, and then I changed my major, and I transferred schools. So all of those things combined contributed to having to spend extra time in college.
How many credit hours did you, or semester hours, did you lose on your transfer?
I didn't lose any, but every school has different requirements as far as generals go. So credits that would have been useful at one school aren't quite as useful at another school.
Should try to re-answer. Re-ask my question.
Go ahead.
How many semester hours then did not benefit you coming in that was previously were of merit at your home school?
That's tough to figure out. Probably I would say about a semester's worth, which is about 16.
Thank you.
And one other thing on the health insurance, is the university require that you weren't covered under your father's insurance?
The University of Minnesota does require that you have health insurance, and I have actually never had health insurance before in my entire life because my family couldn't afford it. So,
what's the expense on that?
It's $650 per semester.
And so, do the members know, does Minnesota do the same thing?
No.
My daughter bought insurance when she went to Vancouver. I don't remember how much money she got.
Mr. Chair, I think it's available, but it's not required like it is at the U.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions on the two witnesses? Thank you. How's that windmill doing, by the way, Donna?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's wonderful.
I want one up in Virginia, too. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next we'll have Frederick Will Kellogg and Chris Brinkman from the University of Minnesota Duluth, my alma mater. Welcome. How are things in Duluth?
Wonderful.
Was it 30 below the other day?
Bad.
Oh, yeah.
We're just
doing
now.
There was, as a saying, who was it, Capote, that said the coldest, well, how does that go again, Representative Atkins? Help me out on that. The coldest day I ran was one summer in Duluth or something like that. Yes. Okay. Welcome to the committee and go ahead. However you want to do it, whichever one wants to lead, just identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Rubino. I'm just the committee.
I am Chris Brinkman. I'm a senior at UMD. We'll be graduating with political science.
My name is Will Kellogg. I am currently a sophomore at the University of Minnesota Duluth with a double major at the moment in political science and economics. And I'm hoping to add a third major of accounting on top of that. I'm actually from Representative Welty's district. I live in Rochester, Minnesota, during the summers.
Well, now, hold on just a second. You've caused some problems, Will. Representative Norton?
You may live in Representative Welty's district, but Rochester stretches across the whole area, and I'll claim you as well.
Will, let me ask you this. Whose campaign did you work on this summer? okay. Go ahead. Start your question.
Thank you. Chair Rupavina and members of the committee, we'd like to begin by thanking you for your legislative support of the Iron Range Scholarship Program. It is currently the largest UMD scholarship this year. And actually this year, 357 of the students from throughout the state are receiving more than $700,000 because of this scholarship. Vice Chancellor Greg Fox has told us that this year, Iron Range scholars at UMD come from 60 of the 67 Minnesota legislative districts. To each of us, it is a reminder of the important contributions of mining on the Iron Range to the economic health and well-being of the state of Minnesota, both today and in the future.
Can I just interrupt you just for a second?
Absolutely.
Representative Welty, did you hear that? Representative Welty, thank you. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Thank you.
When people think of Duluth, we think of, and when students talk about it specifically, they talk about the area of space, from the availability of classes to packed lecture halls to the ability to expand even, which I admit Duluth is in a tough area to expand. But these issues are causing many students to not be able to graduate on time, to not be able to get the correct class in a particular semester and having to wait for perhaps another year in some cases even. These issues have been addressed and are slowly getting better with the new Swenson Science Building, which is giving more availability to science majors, the new Sports and Health, the library that was just put in a few years ago. This year, they broke ground on a new business building, which is going to give a lot more room to our business majors. But this does not address everyone, and it's going to take more time, and more space is needed with the ever-increasing population that is coming. Many students, well, I would say the general consensus of the student population, is very pleased with the business school that is coming about now, just because it is lead technology, it's environmentally friendly, and being a learning institution, we find it's very important that we continue this trend of sustainable development.
Okay. Now we're going to touch on the tuition rates. As I'm sure all of you know, as members of this committee, tuition increases are affecting just about everybody who plans on attending or is attending a higher education institution in this state. As an example of this, I actually did some research on when Representative Rukavina was attending UMD. In his graduation year,
to the credit.
All right. In his graduation year, I won't go into that. He paid $14 per credit hour.
It was way too expensive, too.
I would agree. Today, 35 years later, he...
Did you get an Iron Range scholarship?
Yeah, that's me. We paid $253. This is an increase of 1,800%. Over the past 5 years, the increase has been roughly 75%. On top of this, the grants, with the exception of the grants and scholarships, with the exception of the Iron Range, have been somewhat disappearing. Many students find it nearly impossible to get financial aid and are being forced to take out other loans, which cost a lot more. Personally, I have experienced this because of my family situation. I am not able to get these types of student loans or financial aid from the government. I'm forced to look at other banking institutions. Along with that, the average debt of a UMD grad in 2005 was $26,000. This is causing students to work more hours in order to finance this education, which lowers the graduation rates. I'm not entirely sure what the graduation rates were for a 4, 5, or 6 year student, but if anybody would like that information, I will be glad to find that.
Looking at this from a little bit more of a personal standpoint, I have 2 siblings that are in college right now. My father is a small business owner, so the availability of funds to me through him is, I'm obviously hurt by this. And I do seek out loans, but I also work 70 hours a week. I'm still putting in 30 to 40 hours during the semester. And because I do that, my loans are going to be a lot less. But on the other hand, I take a little bit less of a school load, which I find that many students are doing. On the other hand, I find that many students are seeking out community colleges for their AA degree just so they can avoid the tuition hike from 2 years and then go back to the university. This is not more convenient for them. They're not getting a better education, but because of the financial problems, this is something that works better for them. And I don't think that they'd like to continue that, but it works for them right now. I hope that this information has given you guys a little insight to the UMD students. I want to thank you for your time, and we'd be happy to answer any questions right now that you might have.
Questions of the witnesses? I just, either Will or Chris, do you know how many of your students are telling you that they're having to drop out just because of financial situations? Do you know that?
Sure. You know, I actually have several friends who were freshmen with me last year who have had to transfer out either to Lake Superior College, which is still in Duluth, or return to their hometown to attend school there. I would say the number is probably around a dozen people that I know personally.
Nice button, Representative Hartman. I didn't even see that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I was stuck up to the chair day.
Otis members are Italian flag there for Representative.
You know, the motto for
Curtis and Thomasoni and I, you know, we're all of Italian heritage, so it was one good idea that Senator Thomasoni's had. those were our buttons, and they became collector's items.
I think he also was the one that told me, stick with the Rangers and you're never in danger. So for new members, you might want to adopt that as your motto.
Go ahead, Ron.
My question is, that's what they told me anyway. My question is, did you say that the average debt for the 2005 student graduating from UMD was $26,000, meaning that probably there's people with a lot more and people with a lot less?
I would say considerably more, but it'll get higher.
That's very high for an average.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about a number that are dropping, or not necessarily dropping out, but moving to a more cost-effective option for school. Where are the enrollment numbers at UMD relative to what capacity is, or have they changed, or are they continuing to go up, or are they turning students away? Or
they're still continuing to go up, last I heard.
The admission of students this year actually beat out the, I guess, the amount that they expected to have come in by just under 1,000, I believe.
Go ahead, Randy.
Just one more question. I guess I was just curious if there's a trend today with people transferring out of the university, going to a community college, or going to some other option that's different than existed 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. Because traditionally there have been a lot of people who start in a four-year and move to another option. I mean, that's a fairly common track that a lot of students have taken for a variety of reasons. And I guess I'm just trying to figure out if what you suggested is driven by economics, or if it's just the trend that has existed for many, many years.
It may very well just be the trend. I actually have a friend who left last year, went to a community college in his hometown of Winona, and has returned this year. So the trend might actually be just as you stated.
Representative, that's probably a good question for the university and the Minsk systems when they come in, but more for the university. And I don't know if I see the lobbyists up in the audience. Donna, would you care to comment on that? Or okay, that's fine. Representative Martin.
I was going to piggyback on that same question, and you're kind of getting to a point that I don't think the students today should be expected to answer, but I would be interested in knowing if there is a change in trend or if it's a continuing trend, and also you hear, at least anecdotally, that there is a higher dropout rate after the freshman and sophomore year of students across the country. I would like to know what it is in the university system and the other colleges that we're talking about, and also how is that reflecting on graduation rates? We may have a lot of students, you know, the same amount of students entering every year, but are we graduating the same number of students or as a percent of the classes? So for future time,
Mr.
perhaps.
Bird, could you find that information for the committee for both Minsk and the university systems, and perhaps even the private colleges.
Excellent. Thank you for that.
Okay. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, and I think I know the answer, too, but along with struggling for paying the tuition, students, I assume, are also struggling with car payments. So they got other bills besides?
Mr. Brinkman, you want to handle that one? Do you have a hot, souped-up car and a snowmobile and everything?
I don't have all that right now, no. But I mean, there's the cost of tax, there's the cost of living, there's food, there's insurance. So, yes, there are many overhead costs there.
Just a question on piggyback on that. Did you two have to buy individual insurance, or did you get your health insurance through your parents?
Parents.
I have health insurance through my parents, but it is required before you can register for your classes, you must show proof that you have health insurance or sign up for it at that time.
And maybe a question for you, Doug. Is that required then in NCO2, or is this a recent thing, or is this kind of like a long, ongoing requirement at the university?
Mr. Chair, as long as I can remember, the university has required students to have some kind of health insurance, either through parents or offered it. I don't know off the top of my head if Minsky requires it. They do offer it to all students. I'll have to check to see if it's a system requirement or not.
Okay. Any other questions of the
Mr. Chair, again, my question probably isn't for the students so much, but along those lines, I'd like to know, is there a minimum number of credits a student needs to carry per semester in order to then show proof? Or are you saying that no matter if you're taking one credit or 16 credits, you need to show proof of insurance?
Well, you go ahead on that one.
Before you register for any class, mm-hmm. you must put that information in. You're not allowed to register for absolutely anything.
Thank you, Will. And I did have a non-traditional student who just went to pick up one credit to get, I believe, a master's. I can't remember. She actually complained to me here right after the elections, at an election night party, in fact. And we have quite the election night party. She was required to buy health insurance for one credit, I believe. So, okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. And next we'll have Max Page and Monica Heth come down, who are going to school here in the Twin Cities. While they're coming down, I just want the committee to know this. The other members, or the other testifiers, brought up the Range Scholarship. And about 12 years ago, what it used to happen, you know, there's a Permian University Fund in the constitution when we became a land-grant college and a state. The University of Minnesota got lands around the state to raise money off of, much like K-12 education did. And just so happened that the land that they had up north had minerals on them. So most of this money has come from minerals. And about 12, 14 years ago, I think it was the 93 session, working with Ms. Peterson and former Professor Enfante, we stopped the money from flowing into the endowed chairs account during the Perpich administration. Prior to the Perpich administration, this $200-some million, it must have been then, was just added to the bottom line of the university, and the legislature deducted it and said, here, you got money to operate. Well, in the Perpich administration, they took that money and they put it in an endowment. Well, it wasn't an endowment, and it can only use the interest, and they said, the interest you generate off it, you can sponsor these endowed chairs. The endowed chairs bring in approximately $500 million a year into the Twin Cities economy. Thank you, Iron Range, and Representative Lofty, your education earlier. But we stopped it that year, and we said any new money coming in would be split between the NRI research facility at the Coleraine Lab for minerals research, and the other half would be put into the scholarship account, which Donna had promised us that the students would know where it came from, so they named it the Iron Range Scholarship. And right now, I believe 20% of all incoming freshmen at the University of Minnesota campuses, we prorated it and had to be equally divided, are getting $1,000 to $2,000 a year. Members, we should really, you know, we got $1 billion one time at the end of this June 30th biennium. Perhaps we should think about doing for the Minsky system and maybe augmenting the university system with some of our money to put it in an endowment for scholarships, which Minsky doesn't have the luxury of having that, and helping augment the university's endowment, because that money's there, it grows forever, you can't touch it, maybe until the next crisis, but we never could touch the university's money. And it's been a very important part of helping a lot of these students have some money to go to school. So that's just a thought, and welcome to the committee, to the two of you. I don't know, Ms. Page or Ms. Heth or Mr. Page, which one of you wants to start first, but just go ahead.
My name is Max Page. I'm president of the Minnesota Student Association at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, and also my first 2 years at the university, I was an Iron Range scholarship recipient as well. Much appreciated, and history lesson was good too. The lobbyists and everyone for the university will give you all the facts and figures and everything that you'll need to know, I'm sure, and earn their pay. But I'd just like to take my time to step back a little and look at what the university offers, especially at the Twin Cities campus. It's a place where people from different experiences get to experience new things. This is from around the world. I've played soccer on intramural teams with Ethiopians and people from Greece, and that's been a great experience, as well as places from all around the state and around the country. And I think that's one thing that's often forgotten, is that at the University of Minnesota, you get people from different backgrounds coming together. At the university, they're then able to experience a whole bunch of, a dearth of new things. Traveling abroad, there's not a lot of people, at least where I was growing up, that could afford to take trips to Spain or Russia or anywhere around the world like you're able to do at the University of Minnesota. It's something that you don't either have the money for, or you have other commitments that you're not able to do. So traveling abroad is just an example of one of those things. Student groups are thriving at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. Those are the things that help retention rates and help graduation rates, and so those are greatly encouraged, and very few barriers exist for those. And from these experiences, it blossoms into opportunities, and those range everywhere from research and developing the Honeycrisp apple, our state apple, or to the open heart surgery, or I think the ultimate example of what the university has the possibility to do is Norman Borlaug being able to feed what are estimates around 1 billion people around the world. It's quite a statement to say one of every six people in the world live a better life because of a University of Minnesota graduate. And so I think a lot of these things in the discussions about money and grants are forgotten, and that students, when they come in the university, they're ambitious, they're optimistic. They remind me of this cat I just got a few weeks ago that kind of wanders around and looking at everything. She just found her way up on top of our fridge now. But this is the same way that college students think. They're looking at all the possibilities, and I think that we should have as few barriers for them as possible.
Thank you.
All right, I just want to say thank you for being here. My name is Monica Hess, and I'm a senior at the University of Minnesota, a political science grad student. And Max got to talk a lot about the wonderful opportunities that people can have at the U and really trying to put some more material behind what we normally just think of dollars and cents. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the daily life that students live at the university, especially unique to the Twin Cities campus, but it can be quite harrowing. And there can be a lot of extreme challenges and barriers that students have been facing, especially with the funding commitments and the changing atmosphere that's been going on from the state. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about what students do see as the barriers and things that I continually hear that they're unhappy with and that are really hard for them to do. And we've heard a lot about just tuition expenses and how that's getting out of control. And I think it's even more of a concern for Twin Cities campus sometimes because our housing that we pay for is so expensive, and a lot of times it's unsafe. A lot of times there's not any kind of accountability for landlords. They don't have to come and fix anything. Just a story. My friend Austin, he lives in an apartment, the same landlord I have, but a different apartment, and their heat broke. And he called every day, you know, 4 or 5 times, and he got no response for a week. And that's illegal, right? You have to have heat in your apartment in the winter in Minneapolis. But the problem is the students' rights are very easily overlooked. And I think that that's something that is really important to take into account because on top of not only the tuition that people pay, they're facing all of these other expenses. And I think that a lot of students at the university are really starting to feel that the value of education that they're getting isn't necessarily worth the money that they have to put out. And it's not necessarily worth all the time that they do have to spend working a full-time job along with trying to manage a full class load. So, for example, I had a professor last semester for one of my classes, and he worked at a lot of different universities. He worked at the University of Michigan, he worked at Johns Hopkins, worked at a lot of community colleges throughout Michigan. And, you know, one day he just stopped class and he said, "Why are you guys so stressed? I have never seen an unhappier group of students than I see, you know, right here. What is going on?" And he asked, you know, how many of us have jobs? How many of us have to work in order to even afford, even with taking out loans, being able to afford to basically live day to day? And almost our entire class raised their hand that they had a full-time job. And I feel very lucky. My parents didn't go to college, and they saved their entire life to be able to send me. So I'm unique in the fact that I don't have a lot of debt coming out. But that's one of the reasons that I get to do these opportunities. It's one of the reasons why I get to come and talk to you guys today, is because I'm not working at my full-time job. And it has huge repercussions across campus because everyone is so concerned, so busy, they have a very hard time actually putting the time needed into their classes or putting time into a campus community. I mean, when you guys, you know, went to college or when I went to high school, I remember all these great opportunities for people to get together and just have fun. And those things are really becoming few and far between for many students because they are trying to not only go to college but live an adult life and have a real full-time job, something that is, you know, impossible for anyone to do, I think. And so it's just, I really wanted to stress just kind of the daily life of students and the things that people do have to go through. So I just wanted to touch on that and talk about the campus community, how I think it's really important that we continue to try, especially on a Twin Cities campus, to keep the diversity high, and the only way to do that is to keep costs down. And I just have read a lot of reports even about how now corporations realize diversity increases corporations' profits, increases levels of workplace happiness, and I think the same thing holds true for the university. So I guess I just wanted to stress how much that perspective change is important to students.
I really thank both of you for like a little different twist on the testimony we've heard, maybe especially to you, Monica, for bringing us down to earth a little bit here and realizing, you know, the stress, I guess, on your life, especially when those kids raise their hand. What's the average hours a week that they're working? Full-time
40
job?
40 over if they can. I mean, if it comes between doing your homework or being able to pay your rent, you be able to pay your rent. And I mean, that really hurts the level of education for everyone in a class. If you can't have discussions, if people just don't physically have time to do their homework, I mean, what kind of education are you getting? How much does it work?
Regarding the landlord issue, does the university or do they keep an eye on landlords? If you know, it's private, Ms. Peterson? I know that Representative Junkie and I were with our Keith in our apartment, and it was tempting not to have to snuggle up just to be warm. We complained for a week straight. And we finally, I threatened to bring firewood down from the range and burn it on the living room floor. We finally got it fixed. Representative Mo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I think you know I teach at Michigan State University, and it's interesting they bring up the housing as a challenge, and it is a challenge for our students as well. But we have a couple of issues on the table up in Bemidji, and maybe you could comment on how this might be down here in the Twin Cities. We have older dormitories, the kind of dormitories were built when I went to college, maybe when Chair went to college, you know, where you bunk two students in a relatively small room. There are certain restrictions behind your behavior in the dormitory. You know, when you get caught, there's ramifications for those. So the kind of the claustrophobic dorms lifestyle that we grew up in, most students aren't very interested in living that way nowadays. So there's a lot of them choose to live in Bemidji. And the housing pressure in Bemidji is pretty high. The rents are pretty great. Displacing maybe some other low-income residents. But because of the demand for those housing units, there's really very little incentive for landlords to upkeep those housing units, so they can get pretty run down. So I guess a couple of comments and questions then for you, follow up for you. I think that the university, Minsky, and maybe the University of Minnesota, we're working on trying to update our dorms to make them more accommodating to the lifestyle of modern students. I think that's our part. But from the student perspective, you know, we obviously need students to be trying to support and live on campus. You know, it might cost less, and to help us bring down the cost of housing for you and provide a better living situation. Maybe you could comment on that and describe if that's a similar situation down here in the Twin Cities or not.
Sure. I was a community advisor in the residence halls after living there for a year as well. And so I saw and the housing and the facilities provided as well as a required meal plan make students, which is fairly expensive. It's probably a little more expensive to stay in the residence halls than to move out, cook for yourself, pay your own utility bills and everything. And so some of those incentives would have to be in place. At the same time, when I was a freshman, all these factors were compounded in the death of three students from a landlord who wasn't taking care of their house. And it's a one-time experience, but those are three students. Maybe there's another Norman Borlaug there that, you know, did not get a chance to succeed. And so yeah, I think, especially after that incident, the concerns of anyone living in neighborhoods around the university or anywhere in the city, I think it caused that much more concern.
Let me just interject. The dorms, I hated them. I couldn't wait to move out of them. It's hard to sleep. It's hard to study. And you have to buy, I mean, I think Max understated it. It's a ridiculously expensive meal plan. You have to have one. You have to have one that, 21 meals a week is the least that you can buy. I think the biggest thing would be you have to give students a kitchen. I think that's a number one concern because, you know, how great is dorm food? And when you're forced to buy it at $7 a meal, it's kind of ridiculous.
Go ahead.
No, follow-up question. So do you think that it's a freedom issue for students, or it's a cost and kind of
lifestyle issue for choice of dorms versus living off campus?
I think it's a combination. I mean, it's all about in probably trying to invest in what makes you the happiest. So you'll pick the cheaper option unless it makes you prohibitively unhappy, I would guess.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to get to Representative Thiessen's bill, I guess, if we have time. So I'll just be quick. I know there's a housing clinic at the law school, and Larry McDonough from the Legal Aid Society runs it. And there is recourse for tenants against landlords that don't provide heat. I used to sue landlords that didn't provide heat. It's good fun. And I just wanted to touch on a point that you made about the fact that you're able to be here because you don't have to be at a job right now, and you might have a little more flexibility than some other students. And I think for all the students that have been here, we have to think about the students on those campuses that couldn't be here, that were probably listening to the more well-off of the students facing these tuition bills.
Thank you. Representative Welkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe Representative Hortman sort of addressed this point already, but at Minnesota State University of Mankato, when I was a student, they provided free legal services, and we actually paid for that through our student fees. I'm just recommending that to those members in the audience. If the University of Minnesota doesn't already provide legal services to students, that might be something for them to consider to build into that. Otherwise, I know that there are free services that you can take advantage of throughout the state of Minnesota to help people like you in the positions that may not have the finances available to go after your landlord. But if the landlord's not complying with state law, then you can take legal recourse.
There is a legal service included in our tuition, but again, it's also a time issue.
Mr. Chairman, you're dealing with 27,000 students. It's also hard to educate that many people at once. So it's something we attempt to do, but our notes.
Okay, well, thank you both for a new twist on the testimony. Then our final testifier is Aaliyah Soini. Welcome to the committee. Yes, Rosh Hashem Ethan.
I just thought that was kind of stupid. It was kind of interesting last statement. It's hard to educate students.
We are smart to educate legislators too, but we keep trying. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to speak on behalf of graduate students. I'm Aaliyah Soini, as I was introduced. I grew up in Maynard, Minnesota. I went to college in St. Peter at Gustavus Adolphus. And now I live in St. Paul and go to the University of Minnesota Minneapolis campus. So I have made my rounds around Minnesota. Currently, I'm a fourth year in the history PhD program, and I'm the president of the Council of Graduate Students, that's the representative body of all graduate students at the Twin Cities and Duluth campus, and the main liaison with the Graduate School Administration. In May, we completed a comprehensive survey of graduate student experiences at the U of M, and so it's from these data and my personal experiences that I base most of my comments. As a summary just of the survey data, I'd like to share with you that most comments related to finances and relevant to the legislature are focused upon making university graduate programs accommodating of students with families or dependents. Graduate students tend to differ most significantly from undergraduate students because they tend to be older, later 20s, early 30s. A number of the students remarked on the burden of rising tuition, especially for part-time students who tend not to be eligible for tuition waivers or assistantship benefits. International students are particularly hard hit by financial constraints, given visa limitations. Usually they can't hold off-campus jobs, their spouses can't hold any jobs, and they're ineligible for loans. They also have to supply the same health insurance as was talked about earlier, so when you have a family that's unable to work, that gets to be quite a burden. Summer funding, travel funding, and affordable housing are the other issues among the most frequent requests from graduate students. To touch on the housing issue, for graduate students are not eligible to live in the dorms. Many of them would really like to because it is a cost-saving option. There is some graduate student housing, you have to be married to live in it, and there's a wait list, and some of that also has issues with
code and quality of maintenance, but that is something that graduate students would use more often if it was available, but it just isn't. Personally, based on my own experiences, I know college tuition is too high. I worked two jobs through college. I had to supply my own health insurance because my parents weren't able to do that, which meant working enough hours at Walmart to qualify for health insurance, in addition to my student employment, and one summer even having to get a quick stint of a job at McDonald's because I owed $1,600 and needed to come up with it quickly. I thought that going to graduate school, given that I have a tuition waiver, would actually be a breeze, right? Like, they give you a stipend and you don't have to pay tuition, and they give you health insurance, like, right? I had it made. That wasn't exactly true. When I left undergraduate, I had $25,000 in loan debt. I now have $40,000 after 3.5 years in graduate school. And I'm actually one of the lucky ones. I'm married to somebody who works full-time as an engineer. I think that the system is actually built for people like this. I know many graduate students have a spouse who works in regular employment. But there are also many less fortunate who have families or have to live alone, which is horribly expensive. The cost for a dependent on a pared-down version of our health insurance is $120 a month. Dental insurance is non-existent. That is somewhat a burden for students themselves, even more of a burden if you have children or a spouse. The average monthly income of graduate students on the base rate is $1,200, so $120 for one dependent would be one-tenth of their salary. Students without tuition waivers pay $5,000 to $9,000 a semester more than me, plus the cost of health insurance. They are the most affected by skyrocketing education costs, but whether you have a tuition waiver or not, I think it's important to recognize that graduate students feel the pinch of rising financial constraints, whether they pay tuition directly or not. Right now, the fringe rate that our departments pay on our behalf in order to pay our tuition is 80% of our salaries. So if we make $13,000 per school year to teach classes, our department is paying another 80% of that $13,000 on top of that in order to cover our benefits. This has become quite prohibitive for the departments, which are having to scale back the number of graduate students they accept, or cut funding from other places, most notably summer funding and travel funding. Our department has worked very hard to have a private endowment to provide the graduate students with these extra measures of financial aid. But when the last round of budget cuts happened and the cost of just doing the bare minimum support for students rose, our extra $1,000 scholarship that we get each year was cut to $578 per student. The other way that we're directly impacted is that at the beginning of the year, we have all of these fees, which I'm sure you're quite familiar with, and rent payments. Our first full paycheck doesn't come until the end of September, which means that prior to getting our first full paycheck, we've accrued $3,600 in expenses, according to the university expense estimates and the fees. Our first check is not $3,600, so you can imagine the hardship that creates, which is the major reason why many graduate students take out loans, is because you need that money up front to live off of. The other thing is that we're also teachers. We teach undergraduate classes, and we recently were notified that class sizes have been, again, raised, the class size minimums, meaning if you don't hit this minimum, the class is canceled. This is a significant hardship for undergraduate and graduate students who tend to teach more of these alternative classes that are replacing the hybrid lecture discussion section classes. what that means is that instead of having a class of 100 students and a lecture, that a professor lectures three times a week, and then graduate students meet with those students in groups of like 20 twice a week to discuss things and go more in depth. Those classes are being replaced by classes of 100 to 120 with no discussion sections. And those classes are being taught by graduate students, not by professors. This is, I think, a decline in the quality of education that we give students. It's also fewer opportunities for graduate students in sort of more intimate settings. I printed this off last night because this has to do with a personal experience that I had last spring. The Western Civ survey class, the honor section with five students registered for it, was canceled. It was canceled due to limited enrollment, but the students weren't really notified. They got an automated email after the class had started, the day classes had started, saying that their enrollments had been dropped, and so they were no longer in the class. This created some problems, as you can imagine. But what I found really striking by this is that every one of the honors section in the history department had been canceled due to not enough enrollment. Every one of them. The only honors credits given from the history department this semester are in the major paper, which is basically an independent study with a faculty advisor. And one class that says meets with another class, meaning that it's a regular class that the honors students will like do more work outside of class to get their honors credit. I find this to be somewhat abhorrent. It also meant that the TA assigned to teach that extra section of Western Civ lost their job after the semester had already started and got shuffled into another section. I think that these minimums were sort of a panic gesture in order to save money from classes that weren't enrolling their, like, 20 students. It's kind of gotten all of the 5-10 student enrollment classes out. Unfortunately, I think those are disproportionately honors classes, which necessarily don't have as big of a pool to draw upon. And my final example is that with these large sections, there's one class that has 120 students. It's a writing intensive class. Now, teaching writing is a challenge even if you're doing it one-on-one, but I don't know how you teach writing to 120 students sitting in the lecture hall. There are 5 reader graders that read and grade their papers, and they have one revision opportunity, but the people reading and grading their papers never personally interact with any of the students. And I think that moving towards this model of education is a very poor choice, but it's what we've been forced to do in order to meet budgetary requirements. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Sweeney. Is that how you say your last name? Are there any questions for the testifier?
Madam Chair, I have.
Yes.
Is this happening all across in the different colleges you mentioned? The one I think you're in, so for the graduate.
Right. I have the publication from the new enrollment. It's from the College of Liberal Arts. That is the largest college at the University of Minnesota, and it also coordinates most of the required courses for undergraduates. I don't know about the other colleges.
Thank
you. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, my question is this. Did I hear you correctly that in your entry-level, would this be an entry-level writing course at the University of Minnesota that you have over 100 students and that they don't have the individual instructor?
It's not an entry-level class. Okay. That one in particular is a 3,000 upper-level class. Undergraduate students at the University of Minnesota need to take 1,000 and 3,000 level writing intensive credits to graduate. So this is one of the upper-level writing classes.
So then just to follow up with that, how many students are there in a entry-level writing course?
22 usually.
Thank you for that clarification.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes.
I'm sure. Well, Representative Thiessen's coming on, I believe, to present his bill. I just would move his
House File 40 be recommended to the pass and re-refer to Representative Murphy's Education Finance Committee, I believe, is the proper motion. Representative Murphy, is that correct? Do you want to see this, Representative Murphy?
Yes, Chair.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Representative Rukavina, for that motion to move it to Representative Murphy's committee. Do we need a motion to approve that we can go ahead? Representative Thiessen, you can go ahead and speak to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Rukavina for moving the bill. It's been interesting sitting. I'm glad I had the chance to actually sit in and listen to some of the students here, too, because it's I don't think I've ever been in higher ed, but it was that was helpful perspective. This bill gets a little different group of students, or it's intended to help out a little bit different group of students than I think the folks you heard from at least today. The idea behind the bill basically is that we all have an interest in improving the educational attainment of kind of all Minnesotans, including older folks and people who are non-traditional students, people who went to work right away after high school and then want to pursue a higher education later. You know, employers have an interest in that because it makes them more productive. Employees have an obvious interest in improving their wages and educational attainment. But as a state, we do too, because the higher, the, you know, more productive our folks are, the better off all of us are. And so that's kind of what this is getting at. It's focusing. The gist of the bill is that an employer who pays part of the tuition for one of their employees to go back to school and get a higher, either get a degree or a different kind of degree or additional training, would get a tax credit for the state, and is trying to create a partnership so that the state has some of the financial interest in covering the costs there through the tax credit. The employer has some of the financial stake in this through paying part of the tuition, and then the employee, obviously, pays part of their tuition at all as well. And so it's because the benefits are kind of holistic, the partnership would kind of do get at that as well. And the reason, a couple other things, it's pretty self-explanatory. So there's a tax credit. It only applies if the employee works 30 hours a week, so it's close to a full-time employee, and earns under $12 an hour. That number was really kind of picked out of the air, so I'm happy to change that number if people want to. But the idea being that it's kind of the people that it helps the most and the state benefits the most from are people that move from lower wage jobs to higher wage jobs. And so that's why that number was picked. That's about $24,000 a year for a full-time employee. And the only other thing I guess I would put out there is Minnesota, as you probably all know better than I do, does fairly well in terms of having the number of college graduates we have and the number of people in graduate school. But one place where we actually are kind of middle of the pack, and the last numbers I have are from 2002, but we ranked 29th in the number of people in college who are over 25 years old. And so that's kind of, and it's going to be an area as, you know, our economy changes and things move rapidly, an area where we need to, I think, do better in retraining people, getting people higher degrees, more learning, so they can be more productive. And as the demographic shifts that Representative Atkins likes to talk about a lot, you know, we're going to have to support a lot of people with a lot fewer people, so the more productive our folks can be, the better off we are. So that is the presentation of the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, I'm wondering if you would consider changing the 12 to a 20 as a friendly amendment. I'll tell you our company, John's Auto Parts in Blaine, the people that are making $20 an hour aren't exactly living high on the hog and would really benefit from this. And then if you can address that, but also I'm wondering, what about to the employee? Would there be a different bill, or would it be within this bill that you would address the issue of not having to be taxable income to the employee to get this benefit?
Madam Chair, I'm open to $20. I think the ultimate issue on where we set that number is going to be how much it's going to cost. So yes, that, and we can, but I'd be open to that amendment today if you want to do that. And then we don't have a fiscal note, obviously. And as to the other issue. My understanding is because of the way this is drafted, and we're linking up with a federal definition, that the portion of money that the employer would pay towards tuition would not be income to the employee. That's my understanding of how it works. Was that what your question was?
It is, because I wouldn't want employees to be dealing with a tax liability at the end of the year that they're not expecting. Because at this wage level, that's a hit that they're not ready for. And it's probably an issue for the tax committee to look at and worry about, but I just would want to make sure that I think it's a great bill. I think it's a great idea, but that it doesn't hit the employee when they don't expect it.
Madam Chair, to that point?
Yes.
Madam Chair, to the point, this bill is going to have to go from Representative Murphy's committee to the tax committee, obviously. And it does certainly have some tax implications, but, you know, I had talked to Representative Peace the other day about the 12, and as he picked it out, you know, he said he just kind of pulled it out of thin air because he was directing it to lower-income people. If he does 16, we qualify. So we can have the house pay for us to go to school, and, you know, and then maybe some of us could be, you know, leaders around here because we need to have a higher ed degree, but that's a whole other issue. But anyway, but I think we have to limit it somewhere, and I guess I don't know if this committee wants to do that as a policy statement or if we want to just let the bill move forward and let the tax committee decide what the you know, tax liability is. But I think actually you bring up a good point as to who would qualify, what really, you know, is a livable wage, and you're not really talking about wealthy people at $20 an hour even. Around $40,000 it would be, and I don't know, whatever the feeling of the committee would be to set that number here. I was thinking more at $15 an hour, it would be about $31,000, and that might be something that would give the employees an incentive to do it and still kind of be manageable for the tax committee to look at, but whatever the committee does, Madam Chair, is up to the committee here.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would move to $20 because I really, a family of four on a $40,000 is not, like I said, living high on the hog, and I think 15 is too low.
Representative Portman is moving to amend the $12 to $20. Is there any discussion? Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On to that point, and that's where I was originally going to discuss. By the way, Representative Rukavina, it's presumptive to think that we'd qualify. First, we'd have to get accepted into college. But that aside, my suggestion would be that it's a good issue. It's going to go before the tax committee eventually. It's obviously going to go before Chair Murphy's committee as well. And unless Representative Thiessen has it with him today, which I suspect he can't or doesn't, but let's see what that means. You know, at $12 an hour, how many people will it apply? You know, that data is out there. And at $15 or at $20, and let, you know, when we get there, and it may well be $22. But my suggestion would be let's see where that is. And it's probably appropriate for Chair Murphy's or Chair Lynchesky's committee to figure out where that demarcation is, unless Representative Thiessen, you don't have that data yet.
You're right.
And that's the main question. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, my main question is how many people will it apply? And I would just soon get the bill out of here. It's a good idea. And then just figure that out in a following committee.
All right. Discussion, yes?
To the point. I think there is another set of standards that you can be looking at with job fees and tax abatement and TIP programs that define what is a living wage. So that may be something that you want to tag on to, but I'm for moving it out also.
Other discussion to this point? Representative Portman has moved to amend House File 40, Line 13, by deleting $12 and putting in $20. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed say nay.
No.
Nay.
Okay.
Sorry. Motion prevails, amendment is adopted.
All right.
Good out.
Prevails, member, that the amendment's been adopted. All right. So now, further discussion. I believe Representative Norton.
I'm still wondering how that works. I'm sorry. Okay. I had a different issue, and that was, and I'm not sure if it's Chair Poppe or Chair Rukavina or Chairs. Chairs Poppe. Okay. The question is, it's really a possible amendment, I guess. I'm concerned with your last sentence and a half, starting with after revenue code, where it says, but excluding programs leading to law, business, medical, or other advanced academic and professional degrees. And I'm concerned on several levels. One is, what difference does it make what kind of level someone eventually gets to? The higher the better, I guess, as far as I'm concerned. But the other issue is, how do you know to what point, what degree is going to lead to a professional? You may be going into nursing and end up switching into pre-med or medicine, and I guess I see that as very hard to define. And what if someone does switch career paths and become a professional? Are they going to have to pay it back? Or I guess I'm questioning the need for that portion of the bill, and maybe you can address that for me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the idea there, you're right about the language. I think that in terms of the ambiguity, I think the idea here is that part of it is focusing our resources, you know, and so you're narrowing your, by narrowing the, well, who can apply, you're spending less money and we're targeting it. And I think the thought being that if the goal is to kind of move people from lower wage jobs to higher wage jobs, these types of graduate programs, you know, law, business, medical, it's kind of not what was being aimed at with the bill. It was kind of more vocational and technical kind of education and undergraduate degrees. And so that's why that was. I mean, I think we could take out the leading to portion. I mean, to clarify that. I mean, that's a very good point, to clarify that, but that's the reason those are in there.
And Chair Poppe, yes. Could you then amend it, or would you be willing to amend it to say vocational, technical, and undergraduate degrees, period, if that's what you're really hearing for?
And Representative Keeson?
Sure. Madam Chair, yes. Why don't we make that amendment if you want to clarify it that way, and we can work out the, if we need to change it again.
We'll have Ms. Novak actually address this, perhaps.
Madam Chair and members, I think the easiest place to add the amount or to limit what this is being paid for would be on line 10, where you would say for payment of undergraduate tuition and fees for post-secondary education, and then remove the last clause on line 16 and line 17, everything after the comma, including the comma. Would that work?
I think it would. Does undergraduate pick up vocational and technical? But I don't know the meaning of that. Okay, and the only other thing I would add, Madam Chair, we can deal with this at maybe in tax committee. I don't know if that clause is modifying the Internal Revenue Code definition. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, it is not modifying the Internal Revenue Code definition.
Okay. I'd be fine with that.
Okay. So everyone understands what the amendment is?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think it's a good amendment. It was another question I had asked. But, you know, just for maybe for some safety measures, could we still keep the law degree in, you know?
My only comment on that, Representative Rukavina, I think the discussion you had about how important lawyers are to getting after those landlords is a very good example of...
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I was hoping that some of the lawyers on the committee and in the audience would pick up on that, figure out that we've got a law school at the University of Minnesota, and perhaps some pro bono work could be done on behalf of the students by the law school, and it wouldn't cost them anything. You know, I'm just, who am I? I'm just a ranger.
I do a lot of pro bono work, Representative Rukavina, but it's not always intended.
All right. Well, Representative Norton has moved to amend House File 40 as follows. On line 10, after of, add undergraduate. And on line 16, delete language after the code and insert the period. So everything after code and insert the period, delete line 17. Okay, all those in favor to the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. That amendment does pass. All right, now further discussion to the bill as it's been amended again. I think previously we had Representative Athens on the list. He's spoken now, so you're clear on that. And Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, just some clarification on the bill itself. I'm just wondering, when it says income tax credit for post-secondary education expenses paid by the employer for employees who work 30 hours, does that mean the employer has to fully fund the education and tuition and books, or additional, can you give me some clarification on that, please?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes. It doesn't have to be fully funded. You get a tax credit for the amount that you're paying toward it. And this again, and in terms of the book, what's covered, and maybe Ms. Novak can explain that, because it comes back to the definition of the IRS definition.
Thank you again. We'll turn to Ms. Novak.
Madam Chairman and members, this bill further restricts what's eligible under the IRS code for educational benefits programs. Under that program, if you set up one of those programs, books and other miscellaneous expenses are eligible for the deduction. This narrows that eligibility down to just tuition and fees. So it's not... it's not as expansive as the educational benefit under the IRS code.
Representative Thiessen, did you have any comment?
No.
No. All right. Representative Severson.
Currently, there's no provision for state tax credits under current state law.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And just one more follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So is this dollar for dollar for matching employers' contributions new tax credit up to $2,000?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Correct, and that's my understanding, yes.
Other questions? We had Representative Hawes on the list. Did you have a question?
No more.
And Representative McFarland.
Madam Chair, point of clarification. When I'm reading line 1.8, it says credit for employer education expenses, and then it says a taxpayer may take a credit. And then on line 110, it says the taxpayer for payment of tuition. Who's actually paying the tuition? And is taxpayer in that instance really mean employer?
Madam Chair, Ms. Novak can correct me, but I think the provision this comes under, the taxpayer is referring to the employer. So it's a section within a larger section, and
okay.
So it's the employer.
I appreciate the clarification.
Any other questions? Okay. Anybody else have questions? All right. We have actually amended House File Number 40 a few times, but if there's no further discussion, this has been recommended by Representative Rukavina to move House File 40 as amended, that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Education, Finance, and Economic Competitiveness Division. And all those in favor say aye.
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 And those opposed say nay. Then this bill has been passed on to that committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, good job. We got a bill out of here.
Is there any other business come before the committee today? If not, we will stand adjourned.